Our guest is Robin Baird, a senior research biologist with Cascadia Research Collective. For decades, Robin has studied the behavior, population dynamics, and human impacts affecting dolphins and whales in Hawaii. His work has helped uncover critical insights about Hawaii spinner dolphins, false killer whales, and other nearshore species, particularly how tourism, vessel traffic, and human interaction affect their resting behavior and long-term survival. He provides his results to the scientific community, conservation managers, and the general public to ultimately benefit the conservation and management of protected species. In Hawaii, where snorkeling and ocean recreation are deeply woven into both resident life and visitor experience, understanding marine mammal behavior isn't just about conservation, it's about safety, awareness, and kuleana. Today, with Robin, we're going to explore what research actually shows about human impacts, what spinner dolphins and whales need in terms of their rest and interaction, what responsible ocean interaction really means, and how better understanding wildlife can keep both people and marine mammals safe. Robin, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
I have this book in front of me. The Lives of Hawaii Dolphins and Whales: Natural History and Conservation by Robin Baird. It's a great book. Put it at the end of our interview that people can get. It's so well done because you've identified just not just spinners or not some of the dolphins I'm aware of, but very many different kinds of species. So why don't we start and you tell us how you got involved working with cetaceans in the Hawaiian Islands and why that's important.
I first started working in Hawaii in 1999. I had been living in Nova Scotia, Canada, and was offered a job on Maui with a research group there. So when I moved to Maui, I didn't want to overlap with other researchers or sort of reinvent the wheel. So instead of studying humpback whales or spinner dolphins, I focused on some of the lesser known species. And at the time, that included bottlenose dolphins, pan-tropical spotted dolphins, and false killer whales, which would all use the channel between Maui and Lanai. In 2002, I expanded that work to Kona and Oahu, and then in 2003 to Kauai. And the work has always been sort of multi-species and multi-questions. So when we would go out on the water, we would work with whatever species we encountered, but the amount of time we spent with different species really would depend on how often we encountered them. So, species we encountered extremely rarely, we would spend more time with because we wanted to take advantage of those rare opportunities. So, that includes species like false killer whales, which I mentioned, but also pygmy killer whales, two different species of beaked whales. Dwarf sperm whales, species that not only had not been really studied in Hawaii, but have not been studied almost anywhere else in the world. And we use a whole variety of methods. The basics is just photo identification, getting photographs that we can use to identify individual dolphins and whales. And we have catalogs of 15 different species from Hawaiian waters. But then we also were collecting biopsy samples, little skin and blubber biopsy samples that we could use for genetic analyses and for various other types of studies, and also tagging studies. So in the early days, we were tagging different species with suction cup attached tags that had basically little computers on board that would record diving behavior. And then since about 2008, we started using satellite-linked tags to examine movements and behavior. So, yeah, a lot of different species working throughout the islands, and also with a lot of important collaborators on various parts of the research efforts.
So, why do you think, to our listeners, why is that important? Everybody should know about this, about their behavior. And we get in the ocean like it's a playground, and part of this show is about providing research and information to keep people safe in the ocean. And the ocean is also a habitat for the mammals that you have been researching extensively for the last 20 years. And before we started this conversation, you said every island's different about how people are responding to the wildlife in the ocean. So wherever you want to start that conversation, Robin, I'm
Yeah.
willing to.
Well, I think most importantly is Hawaii was home to all of these different species of whales and dolphins long before the Polynesians ever discovered the islands. And from some of the genetic studies, a species like false killer whale, those false killer whales around the main Hawaiian Islands are resident to the islands, and they've probably been resident for tens of thousands of years. Hawaii has incredible diversity of whales and dolphins. There's 11 different species that are resident to the islands, and even for some of those resident species, some of them have multiple separate populations among the islands. So, for example, the rough-toothed dolphins off Kauai and Niihau are different from the rough-toothed dolphins off of Kona. They're separate populations. And in terms of how the different species vary among the islands, that not only do the human populations differ among the islands, but so do the populations of whales and dolphins. So off of Kona, for example, there's 11 different resident species that are found there, whereas off of Kauai and Niihau, there's really just four different resident species, maybe five. And the differences between the islands in terms of what species are found may reflect the oceanography of the areas, but they could also reflect human activities. So, as listeners know, Kauai is the home of the Pacific Missile Range facility, the Navy facility on the west side of the island, and that area is an important training and testing area for Navy activities, and has been going on for a long time. And the species of whales and dolphins that regularly use that Navy range, I think, are the ones that are very tolerant of human activities, tolerant of Navy sonar, and have probably been exposed to Navy sonar for most of the individuals for their entire lives. Whereas at the other end of the main Hawaiian Islands, off of Kona, Navy sonar is not used there very often. And there's a number of species that are pretty sensitive to Navy sonar, and just probably wouldn't persist in the area if it was a very heavily trafficked area. I had mentioned that there's differences in the human communities in terms of how they interact with whales and dolphins off of Kona and also off of Oahu. There's a lot of individuals that will go out on the water and go swimming with different species of whales and dolphins off Kauai. There are certainly interactions with tour vessels, but I would say far fewer than off of Oahu or off of Kona.
So what do you say? So to our listeners who want to stay safe in the water, what can you tell us, probably specifically about dolphins to start with? They go out in the bay, let's say it's Hanalei Bay, and they go out and they want to watch all the dolphins, the spinner dolphins. Isn't this wonderful? Can you tell us about their behavior so people can understand why they keep coming into the bay, what they're doing when they're spinning? What are they doing during the early morning hours versus the evening? All of that information would be great.
Yeah, well, spinner dolphins probably get more exposure to human activities than any other species in Hawaii because of their day-night patterns and their tendency to rest near shore during the day. So spinner dolphins do almost all of their foraging at night, and that foraging is usually a few miles offshore in deeper water, and then they come in close to shore early in the morning. Usually right around or shortly after sunrise, and they will spend most of the day, usually until sort of mid to late afternoon, in these shallow nearshore areas like Hanalei Bay and off Polihali. And the spinner dolphins, many species of whales and dolphins in Hawaii have these very strong day-night patterns where they'll feed at night and rest during the day. But spinner dolphins are the only one that does that resting behavior almost exclusively in very shallow nearshore waters. So they tend to, when they first come in the morning, they may move around a little bit, and you'll see a lot of social activities. And then they will sort of descend into a deeper sleep or rest pattern. And that resting pattern may last for 5 or 6 hours before sort of waking up in the mid-afternoon and starting to range more broadly. And you know, based on various studies, they're starting to move out into deeper water maybe 3 o'clock in the afternoon or 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And because their resting behavior is so, the locations for where they rest are so predictable, it's really set them up for a lot of sort of land-based disturbance. And when I say land-based, I mean people swimming out from shore to get close to the dolphins and interact with the dolphins during the middle of their rest period. And it's interesting, folks who have done this type of thing, and we even notice it in our research activities, is it's not surprising, even when you have a group of spinner dolphins that are resting, that one or two of them may come over and approach a boat, or they may come over and approach swimmers. But often it's the juvenile individuals. And I the analogy I use is, you know, kids or teenagers, you know, it's not like they're necessarily resting when they're supposed to rest. They if they're easily distracted, and that doesn't mean that they don't need the rest. That's the same, I think, with spinner dolphins and their resting near shore behavior. There's been a lot of attempts in Hawaii over the years and discussion about how to manage that situation, the human dolphin interactions. A few years ago, National Marine Fisheries Service, which is the regulatory body for whales and dolphins in Hawaiian waters and throughout the United States, set up a regulation, which is a no swim with regulation and a 50-yard approach rule specifically for spinner dolphins. And there was also lots of discussion at the time, and National Marine Fisheries Service is still trying to decide on whether to set up what would be some sort of time area closure. So they might make it so that you weren't allowed to go into a particular bay that's known to be a resting bay for spinner dolphins between, you know, 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. And some of the examples of bays that have been discussed for that are primarily in Kona, but Honaunau, Ho'okena, Galeakua bays. They haven't done that, but the approach rule and the no swim with rule, I think, has dramatically reduced the amount of swimming with spinners that occur. In terms of tour vessels that swim with spinner dolphins, I think that's been almost entirely eliminated. And now most of the swimming with spinner dolphins that occur are from shore-based swimmers. And we did a project last June off of Waianae, coast of Oahu, and we were primarily working with spinner dolphins, but we would regularly see people swimming out from shore and following the dolphins during the day, swimming from shore, and we didn't see any tour vessels do that. I will say that the single species rule that NIMS put in for spinner dolphins did have some unintended consequences, and that's that a lot of the tour companies that used to take people out to sea and swim with spinner dolphins now take people out to sea and swim with other species offshore, species like pygmy killer whales or pilot whales. I don't think that happens off of Kauai or Niihau, but it certainly happens off of Oahu. It happens off of Kona as well. And some of those species have similar behavioral patterns in terms of that nighttime foraging and daytime resting. It's just their daytime resting is further offshore rather than right up in the shallow water areas.
So, if we're talking about resting during the day, why are they spinning during the day? when I
Yeah,
see.
well, I think that, well, two things. The spinning behavior definitely, I think, peaks early in the morning and later in the afternoon, rather than as much during the sort of the core resting period. And I think spinner dolphins spin for a whole variety of reasons. One of the main reasons, I think, is actually to get rid of remoras. So remoras are, basically have, it's not really a sucker, but it works by suction. But the sucker in a remora actually has these backward facing spines that dig in a little bit to the skin. And remoras are hitchhikers. And spinner dolphins, I don't think really like remoras. And if you see a spinner dolphin spinning and get some really good quality photos, you can often see that they have remoras on them, even though sometimes remoras are just a couple inches long, sometimes they're, a foot and a half long. But they're a lot of their spinning is to try to get rid of remoras. And you also see juveniles spin a lot, and it's not, juveniles could be spinning also for play behavior. Play behavior is often thought to be in juvenile animals as it certainly probably feels good and it's fun, but it also probably sort of performs exercise function. It helps them build up their stamina.
So if they're spinning and you're out there in the bay 50 yards away, they're not in their sleeping stage. Is that what you're saying? Like
I
nine
think
to five?
they're probably either just coming out of their sleeping phase or about to go into their sleeping phase. And it's not that they never spin when well, not all individuals in a group of 40 or 50 spinner dolphins are doing the exact same thing at the exact same time. And so while the majority of animals may be resting, in particular, juveniles may still be continuing to play a little bit.
So, how does this accumulation of human interaction affect them? You've been doing research with that. Is our population healthy? Do we have more dolphins and whales than we've had before since you've started this research 2 decades ago? And with the new 50-yard rule, you're telling me you're seeing less interaction. Do you see that all this is a positive contribution?
Well, I personally think that there's pros and cons to interacting with wildlife, and I think that the main thing is it needs to be done respectfully. And doing it respectfully, I think the 50-yard approach rule is a good rule to have to give the animals some space for them to do what they need to do. In terms of the population, there was some great work done by a graduate student a number of years ago off of Kona that showed that the spinner dolphins off Kona were, I think the estimate was around 87 or 85% of their time they had humans near them during the day, and that was considered to be the probably the most exposed to human activity population of dolphin anywhere in the world. There's evidence that the population, the spinner dolphins off Kona have been much more well studied than spinner dolphins elsewhere in the islands, and there was evidence that the population off Kona had declined between the 1990s and the 2000s, 2010s. So I think that population decline may have been at least in part due to human activity. I think there's the basic disrupting sleep patterns is part of it, but groups of spinner dolphins that are using those resting bays off of Kona in particular would, if there's too much human activity, they would often leave and move to a different bay or move down the coast. And the reason why spinners are thought to choose the particular bays that they choose, at least in part for resting, is that these are relatively shallow with white sandy bottoms. And that white sandy bottom is important because if you're a group of dolphins that's resting, they do have to worry about predatory sharks. And if a tiger shark comes into the bay, it's much easier for the dolphins to detect that shark over a white sandy bottom than it is over a deeper, darker substrate below. And I think that there could be an increase in predation by sharks on spinner dolphins, particularly the calves, if they're forced to move from one bay to another during the day. And so, disruption of rest could affect the animals. There's in a couple different ways, but I think the most important one is that if they're not getting that deep rest, they may have to rest more at other times of the day when there's less humans around, when they should be foraging, and that could affect their nutritional state. So I think back in the day when there were less of us around, and less interactions with dolphins, the dolphins just had less stress in their environment. And so anything that we can do to improve their habitat, improve their just minimize disruption of their patterns, the better they're going to do. There's a lot of efforts right now through University of Hawaii and the Pacific Island Fishery Science Center to come up with better population estimates for spinners off of Oahu, off Maui Nui, and off of Hawaii Island as well. And all of those efforts are driven by the need to better understand how the populations are doing. I can say for one other species that we have really good abundance estimation information, and that's the false killer whales around the islands, the main Hawaiian island population. That population is declining, and it's declining at about 3.5% a year. It's a small population to start with. But why is it declining? It's not tourism. I think it's other factors in its environment, things like bycatch and fisheries, or high levels of pollutants. But different species. Some populations of whales and dolphins in Hawaii are probably relatively stable, but others are definitely under some risk.
So tell us a little bit about dolphin IQ so people can know, and even whales also, in terms of their language. How would somebody know they're in distress? And then maybe after we go through that, we could talk about people who fish and how whales and dolphins get caught in nets and all of that kind of information, which I think is really important.
Yeah, well, the social lives of dolphins probably influence or affect what's going on sort of cognitively. Some of these species are very well, they're very social, as anyone who's seen spinner dolphins would know. They're always in groups of anywhere from 20 to 150 individuals. They tend to be thought of as being the reason why they're in groups may be for group defense, detection of predators. And then there's other species that are also social, like false killer whales, that have really long social bonds. The individuals that you see together have probably been together their entire lives. They're cooperative hunters. And that things like cooperative hunting behavior is something that's thought to lead to or involve complex decision making. I don't know that the species are necessarily ranked or considered as to how intelligent one is versus another, but the species that have these long-term social bonds and have to cooperate and work together are probably thinking about things much more complexly than others that are more just worried about where to find food and where to avoid the predators. You mentioned fishing. Let me say, I think there's a lot of different threats to whales and dolphins in Hawaiian waters, and it varies a lot by species. And Those threats include marine debris, discarded cargo nets, plastic rings, those types of things. Marine debris affects most species. We've documented ourselves false killer whale last year that had a loop of polypropylene line that was wrapped around it and was cutting through the dorsal fin. A few years ago, we documented a beaked whale, a Blainville's beaked whale off Kona, that had was wrapped up in a sort of discarded piece of cargo netting. That netting had wrapped right around its beak and probably prevented it from feeding. Other researchers or members of the public have documented spinner dolphins and spotted dolphins with plastic rings around their beak, which could prevent them from feeding. So marine debris is one issue that everyone can do something about, picking up stuff off the beach, picking up marine debris out of the water. I think it's something that people tended to think, well, humpbacks get tangled up in netting or in line. But the more research is done, the more we're all realizing that almost any species out there can get entangled in this in any sort of marine debris. So we talked a little about swimming with animals and how that can disturb them or disrupt their sleep patterns or potentially push them into areas where they might be more exposed to sharks. There's things like persistent organic pollutants. Things like pesticides, DDT, industrial chemicals like PCBs, and species that tend to feed higher on the food web are more exposed to those. So, in Hawaiian waters, the species that have been documented with the highest levels have been killer whales, which are top predators, and false killer whales, which are also top predators. Those types of pollutant issues have both an international and a national component, but also a local component. And false killer whales, in particular, have a particular pesticide, high levels of this pesticide that was used a lot in the pineapple cultivation industry in Hawaii. And so, again, people can do something about that, whether or not it's paying attention if you're a property owner, what pesticides or herbicides you're using on your property, even some consumption issues. If you can afford to buy organic food, then you're buying food that may not have been exposed, obviously, to herbicides or pesticides. If you can afford to buy furniture that doesn't have flame retardants, all of those things leach into the ocean. I will bring up another conservation issue, which is a parasite that certainly it kills a lot of monk seals, but it also kills spinner dolphins and bottlenose dolphins in Hawaii. This particular parasite, it's called Toxoplasma, and it comes from cats. Cats are the definitive host. If there are no cats, there's no Toxoplasma in the environment. And so if it's the leading cause of death for monk seals in Hawaii, the leading disease cause of death for monk seals in Hawaii. Christy West at the University of Hawaii has estimated that over 60 spinner dolphins have died from Toxoplasma. And that's something that people can do something about. If you have pet cats, keep them indoors. And there's been efforts on Hawaii Island to try to eliminate the feeding of cat colonies. Which are just sources of toxoplasma into the environment. I mentioned Navy sonar earlier. That's something we've been doing a lot of research on, and there's good evidence that Navy sonar can particularly affect species like beaked whales. And some of our work off of Kauai is showing quite, in my opinion, quite surprising tolerance of Navy sonar by some other species like pilot whales and bottlenose dolphins. They may be changing their behavior to a small degree, but they're not fleeing from the area entirely. And I think perhaps the last issue that I can think of that you mentioned briefly is this question of fishery interactions. And fishery interactions, I think, really come in sort of two different flavors. One is overfishing and reduction of the prey base for different species of whales and dolphins. If you look at the size of ahi in Hawaii in the 2000s compared to in the 1950s, when fishery data was first available, the ahi back then were about twice the size of the ahi that are being caught today. So there's less of them out there, and they're a lot smaller than they used to be. On the other hand, some other species like mahi-mahi may have been a species that's benefited from the overfishing of ahi. But overfishing, I think, is definitely an issue. And I think that if you have a choice of different fish to eat, it would be good to eat the ones that are fast reproducing and fast growing, like mahi-mahi and ono in particular. Those are two both local species that the populations are probably doing quite well and reproduce quickly. So less concerns about overfishing. And then the problem with several species in Hawaii is that they like to eat the same kinds of fish that we also like to eat. So false killer whales, probably more so than any other species. They're feeding on mahi-mahi, ono, ahi, swordfish, aluas, mongchong, you name it. If we like to catch it, they also probably like to catch it. And the problem arises when the false killer whale sees a fish on a line and takes that fish off the line, and can either get hooked or entangled as a result. I think the vast majority of the time that they might take a fish off of a line, nothing happens to them. But one of the papers that we published a year and a half ago showed that almost a third of the individuals in the population, this main Hawaiian Island population that's listed as endangered, almost a third of the individuals have evidence that they've survived previous hooking or entanglement. So, and that's the population that I mentioned that has been declining in the last decade.
Well, that's really amazing information you just gave me. I would like to know what people should know if they get in an encounter with a dolphin. Can they be aggressive towards that person? I've seen that before with monk seals. People get up very close to them, but we're not really specifically talking about them. I would like to know what people should do, and then I see a lot of information out about people helping dolphins or another mammal because they're entangled, and that can be dangerous for them as well as helping the mammal. What should people do in those situations if they're caught unexpected, fell off a stand-up board, they're right next to a dolphin? Can they expect any kind of interaction that could be dangerous?
Well, I think dangerous interactions are rare. It's certainly possible, but they're quite rare. And I think that if people pay attention to the cues that the animals give us, so one cue that let's say a bottlenose dolphin or a pilot whale that is being aggressive. One cue that they give is a jaw clap, and so opening the mouth and closing it quickly, that's a social signal they use in their own interactions, I think, to express frustration or anger or some sort of aggression. So if someone did happen to be in the water and a dolphin, whether or not it's a smaller species like a spinner or spotted dolphin that could still do some harm. If the dolphin comes up to a person and does that jaw clap, I think that's a good signal that they should just get out of the water. There's two examples I know of in Hawaii of pilot whales being aggressive towards humans, potentially Very risky to the humans. One was one that happened a long time ago. I think it was 1992, and many people have probably seen this one on television. It was made it onto, when animals go bad type videos, and that was a pilot whale off of Kona that grabbed a woman and pulled her down, let go of her, and she came up to the surface. But that could have been a fatal interaction, and it wasn't. And then the other one was more recently, 2013, off of Waianae, and three free divers were following some pilot whales around off of Waianae. Two of them got in the water. This one juvenile pilot whale came back and ended up grabbing one of the fins off of one of the free divers. Took the fin down, and she described it as it was shaking its head side to side, sort of the way a dog does with a bone, or a toy. And they got back into the boat, but then one of them wanted to get back in the water again, so they went back in, and the other person went in basically as a safety person. The same pilot whale came up and grabbed the heel of one of the free divers and started taking him down. And fortunately, keep in mind, these are free divers, professional free divers. These are people who can hold their breath a long time, have spent a lot of time in the ocean, and are, if this is going to happen to anyone, it's probably the least risky to happen to someone like that. But the person was able to reach down into where the pilot whale was holding on to his heel and slip his foot out of his fin, and he made it back to the surface and got back into the boat. And then the same pilot whale turned around and charged the remaining person that was in the water. They were able to get back into the boat, but just as she got back into the boat, the whale came up and basically bit her on the calf. She was wearing a wetsuit, and it didn't close down on both sides, but it punctured the wetsuit and left a bruise on her calf. So, that type of thing can happen, but I should say that in that particular case, it was somewhat predictable in the sense that this one whale had previously shown by grabbing the one fin and shaking it that it was doing something different, and their first instinct was correct, was to get out of the water, and then they just decided to get back in again. And so that was their mistake, is getting back in the second time. If they had paid attention to their first instinct, it never would have escalated and potentially gotten a lot worse. So I think that trying, I think the best scenario is not to go in the water with these animals. Chances are you're disturbing them. But if you're in the water with them, then the important thing is to pay attention to their social signals, to know about that jaw clapping behavior, to know when it's time to get back out of the water.
What about fin slapping? What does that mean in their communication?
Well, I think it. People have tried to understand it, and whether or not it's tail lobbing or peck slapping, or I think it can probably mean a lot of different things. They do it when boats are around, but they also do it when there's no boats around. You can watch them from shore and see the same kind of behaviors, or you can be with a group of dolphins, and dolphins at the far end of the group could be doing that type of behavior. So I think that they're doing it for social communication with other individuals in their social group, or they're doing it for play behavior. We've seen, well, I mentioned spinner dolphins spin to try to get rid of remoras, but we other species like bottlenose dolphins or spotted dolphins will leap repeatedly, trying to get rid of a remora as well. And so if the remora is on its side, they may leap on its side over and over again, or if it's on their belly, they may leap on the belly. So I think that they're doing it for a lot of different reasons, and it's hard to tell in any one case.
Well, I'm going to go back to the book that I mentioned in the beginning. The Lives of Hawaii Dolphins and Whales, Natural History and Conservation, written by Robin Baird. It's an excellent book. So you've done all this research for the last 20 years. How do you think that's impacting their lives and the conditions of the ocean and the people that live here? What have we learned from all this research, Robin?
Yeah, well, a lot of what we do is motivated by trying to address sort of conservation or management concerns, and I mean, we can look at some specific examples of where the work that I've been personally involved in has helped National Marine Fisheries Service recognize that there are multiple independent populations, and thus that they can be managed separately. We've done a lot of work trying to understand the nature of fishery interactions with false killer whales in particular, and you know what can be done to mitigate or minimize those interactions. I think there's still a tremendous amount to be done, and a lot of the work that I'm involved in is also, trying to better understand the impacts of human activities on whales and dolphins, whether it's Navy sonar or marine debris and or pollutants, and trying to raise awareness so that people even realize these are concerns. And the example I mentioned of the false killer whale entangled in this loop of polypropylene line that we documented last year. That's the first time that false killer whales, to the best of my knowledge, have ever been documented entangled in marine debris, and it certainly opened our eyes. And we've always tried to, when we're out on the water ourselves, we've always tried to, okay, this is something that could be an entanglement risk, so let's pull it out of the water. And we particularly pulled netting out of the water, and now it's opened our eyes that it's not just netting, it can be any loop of line or plastic, and we try to spread the word to help others realize what the concerns are and some simple steps that they can take to try to address them. I mentioned earlier that Hawaii is unusual with these 11 different species that are resident to the islands, and just this incredible diversity. A lot of the sort of outreach and education that I've been involved in over the years is just trying to make people who live in Hawaii or who visit Hawaii realize how special it is in terms of that whale and dolphin community that lives there. All the sort of early whale research and dolphin research were focused just on humpback whales or spinner dolphins, and yet just going a few miles offshore, there are all these other species, and I think Hawaii is also sort of an important what we've learned in Hawaii is sort of an important lesson for what could be going on at some of the other Pacific Island nations that have had less resources or less abilities to get outside the reef and really study and learn about what's there, and so finding out that there are resident populations of dwarf sperm whales and pygmy killer whales in Hawaii means that people should start thinking about whether there might be it in Kiribati or other island nations in the Pacific.
What would you say to listeners about our whale population? We do a count every year. Supposedly, Kauai has counted the most so far of humpbacks. You just said we've done a lot of research on humpbacks, not other whales. Do you have any information on that? What we know about humpbacks, why they're here, and just general information? Because we get so many people, like you said, visitors that get in the ocean and they really don't understand the 50-yard rule, right? That I'm sure your research helped create that awareness that they decided we really should have that kind of rule, which you say has helped. So, is there anything you'd like to tell us about whales in general that would be helpful to people?
Yeah, well, humpback whales, of course, come to Hawaii for the winter, females to give birth and males to follow the females. Population in Hawaii in general has been doing pretty well. It was taken off the endangered species list a number of years back. But that said, it also is clear that what happens with humpback whales in Hawaii is really dependent on what's happening over the entire North Pacific. And a couple years ago, the numbers that came back to Hawaii were dramatically reduced. Because of a sort of heat anomaly situation that was happening on their feeding grounds, what was called the blob, this area of very warm water up in the Gulf of Alaska and into the Bering Sea that reduced productivity and reduced prey availability for humpbacks on their feeding ground, and that resulted in a lot fewer humpbacks coming down to Hawaii. So, it's all interconnected, I guess, is one way to look at it. As much as people think that Hawaii is this isolated islands in the middle of the ocean, whether or not it's pollutants or some of these migratory population like humpback whales, what's going on elsewhere in the Pacific plays a big role in terms of what people see and how the populations in Hawaii do. We've also been doing a lot of work with an open ocean population of false killer whales that happens to come past Kona every once in a while, and from some of the satellite tagging we've been doing, those animals are moving offshore and outside of U.S. waters, and that's a case where they're probably interacting with foreign longline fisheries out on the high seas. And so, I think the everything's interconnected is one of the take-home messages. And I think we all have to do our part in terms of how we try to protect and nurture the whales and dolphins that are that we're when we're in their habitat.
I think that's well said. You've brought up some really good points. I had no idea about the toxo, say that word again.
Toxoplasmosis.
Yes, that cats carry that now is affecting dolphins. Is that what you said?
And dolphins, monk seals. Christy West's work at University of Hawaii has shown that even some of the open ocean species of dolphins, things like Fraser's dolphins, are showing up with signs that they've had exposure to this particular parasite. It again, things people can do: keep your cats indoors.
Right.
Discourage people from dumping cats in the environment and so on. So,
Do you feel like that your work had a lot to do with marine fisheries and NOAA putting out the rule for 50 yards from from dolphins and whales? Do you think?
The spinner dolphin we are doing some work with spinner dolphins right now, and we've done some work with spinner dolphins a while back off of Maui. In particular, the spinner dolphin rule was really driven by other researchers and the findings of the population decline off of Kona. But our work has played a big role in going back to false killer whales again, but in the false killer whale take reduction team that was set up back in 2010, and ongoing discussions about how to protect that species. The spinner dolphin work that we've been doing recently is informing sort of the interpretation of surveys, potentially informing survey design, because we're getting a better idea of, spinner dolphins have been studied a lot in the leeward coast of the islands. And we've been satellite tagging spinner dolphins and getting a better idea of how they're using some of the windward coasts as well. Doing work with whales and dolphins in Hawaii has also taught me the importance of patience. And we're in this for the long game, not the short run. And I think that the work that I've been doing has been built on people that have done work with these species in the past, and I hope that others in the future will also build on what we've been learning. I should also mention we've had a lot of graduate students that have been involved in the work. through University of Hawaii Pacific University, Oregon State University, Florida International University, Evergreen State College, and graduate students are both drilling down on some very specific questions from the data sets that we've collected, but they're also the people that are going to take a lot of this research forward into the future. And I think that's just a critical and important part of it as well.
What message would you give visitors, especially that come to our islands and want to go out and see the dolphins or go see the whale in their kayak? What kind of messaging would you like to see out there? Because I don't think there is really any that I'm aware of.
Yeah, I mean, to me, the most important thing is that people show respect. And if they're in a boat, watch from a distance rather than try to get as close as they can. I think if they go out on a tour operation and they don't think that the captain or the guide is showing respect to the animals, they need to say something, whether or not it's to them at the time or in a Yelp review later. I think that I certainly have seen lots of people show respect to the animals, and we try to in our own work. But I've also seen lots of people interacting with whales and dolphins that clearly are not. And I think if we can get more people to show respect for the animals, then that's sort of the basis for good interactions, for good observations, for good relationships, and how that can help the keep the opportunity to continue to see these animals for generations to come.
That's well said. One last question. What's your next project? Is it in the Hawaiian Islands for sure?
Yes, planning on doing some work off of Kona late May, early June. But I should say that one of our team members is based in Kona, and he was out on the water February 1st and got some satellite tags out on some of these open ocean false killer whales. And so we're currently tracking their movements there. This morning they were headed towards Jaggers Seamount, which is west of the island. So even though I'm based on the mainland, all my field work is in Hawaii, but I've got good collaborators and team members that are based in Hawaii that are able to get out and continue things even when I'm not there, so, which is wonderful.
So this is more like a longitudinal study you've been doing, it appears.
Yeah, this is actually our 28th year, so
Wow.
it adds up.
So what is the end game here? Are we going to keep doing this for a period of time, or are you going to move in a different direction, or what are you trying to change or implement here for the Hawaiian Islands for this particular species and for all those that live here in our oceans?
I mean, I mentioned that certainly the motivation for a lot of the work is conservation and management. So I'm interested in science-based management, and so we're trying to provide the science that the managers need in order to make the right decision. And whether or not that's I when NIMS proposed this single species rule for spinner dolphins, I was actually opposed to that because I thought they needed to have a multi-species rule, because if they came up with a rule just for spinners, all it would do is push people to swim with other species, and lo and behold, that's what's happened. Trying to raise awareness about the toxoplasmosis issue is something that I've been working on recently. I gave a presentation last week at an international conference in Fiji that had representatives there from about a dozen different South Pacific nations, many government representatives from these different nations, and most of those had not heard about toxoplasmosis as an issue for whales and dolphins. So part of that's just raising awareness, and the feral cat issue in Hawaii is gotten a lot of attention in terms of the effects on seabirds, in particular where there's cats that overlap with any seabird colonies. It's just devastating. And I'm just trying to raise awareness about the same issue with marine mammals to make people realize what the consequences are. The fisheries work, we work a lot with the state of Hawaii, with the Division of Aquatic Resources, and we've been getting funding support from them, particularly for our work with false killer whales. And we're hoping that that's going to translate into increased awareness and understanding of where the interactions are most likely to be if you're a fisherman, and what you could do about it. We've spent a lot of time producing educational materials and distributing educational materials to fishermen to help them discriminate between the species that might be most likely to take their catch and those that are least likely to take their catch, because there's a few different species that look very similar but feed on very different things. So over the years, we've given out thousands of laminated ID pages to fishermen in Hawaii, I mentioned one of the things I've learned is the importance of patience. I don't think any of these problems are going to be solved in any time soon, and persistence, patience are both really needed. So I have no plans on stopping personally my involvement with the work in Hawaii. So I hope to
You're
be
not
at
the
it
first
for.
person who told me persistence is the game. There's a
Yeah.
Hawaiian here doing a lot of work in water safety, education for kids, and he said his word is persistence, perseverance.
Yep, absolutely. Well,
It doesn't happen overnight.
and for you as well. So, keeping at it, keeping to spreading the word.
Oh. Well, Robin, we should tell our listeners we met each other 20 years ago when there wasn't Zoom, and you came on for a show having to do with the stranding of 200 melon-headed whales in Hanalei Bay. And we really appreciated you coming on and giving your expertise around sonar and how that affects whales and dolphins.
Yes,
So
the
here we are again.
voices of the sea, I think that
Yes.
episode was. Yeah.
That's exactly right. Wow.
Yeah.
Good memory. But
Yeah.
I'm also going to put your link to your book here, which is absolutely fabulous that I bought a while ago, but I find it to be just very impressive. And I'm really impressed with your work, and I appreciate you coming on because we're all trying to make everything safer for everybody, the mammals that live in the ocean and the people that go in it. Right? We're all interconnected. And you're right, we need to respect the ocean. And we've had a lot of people that do a lot of work with science because we want to give people information that they can use to stay safe and help whatever's going on. And what you said is you do science-based management for conservation, which I think is excellent. So thank you again for coming on, Robin. Your research really shows that small repeated disturbances can have a long-term consequence for marine mammals, especially in heavily visited places in Hawaii, which you've said it's caused I can't say that word again.
Toxoplasmosis.
Thank you very much. And that's a big issue that nobody knew about. The idea that they came up with the regulation of not being close to one species, which you were saying, no, I don't think that's going to work. You were absolutely right. So I hope they get the message to change that. When understanding behavior, I think, but knowledge gives us power, just like you gave us this information today, Robin, and we probably could talk for 2 more hours. But knowledge gives us power. Understanding behavior leads to better policy. Better policy leads to safer wildlife. And safer wildlife means a healthier ocean for all of us. Thank you, Robin Baird of Cascadia Research Collective, for sharing your decades of research and perspective. If you care about ocean safety for people and marine life, this work that Robin's doing is worth amplifying. So thank you again.
Well, thank you.
Hope we
Really
can talk
appreciate it.
again in the future.
Yeah. Yeah, appreciate the opportunity to talk with you. Good to see you.
Yeah, it's nice to see you, Robin.